I lived in Germany for a while. And when I did, it wasn't very long, but I had the opportunity to see a number of really amazing places. In fact, one of them, just to back up, saw a lot of castles. Has anyone been to Europe and seen castles? They're pretty amazing. One in particular that's fairly famous, was just a few minutes from where I lived in Darmstadt, Germany. This is actually the ruins of Frankenstein's castle. I'd go up there and read and pray. It was like 5 minutes from my house. It was kind of wild just to think I'm at Frankenstein's castle. I also spent a lot of time in Switzerland. This is Lauterbrunnen. I think this is one of the most beautiful places on earth. I tell people Lauterbrunnen is sort of like you take Yosemite and then put the Tetons up on top of it. It's outside of Interlaken. And fun fact, when Jen came to visit me, she actually wanted to elope here. And I was silly enough to say, no, we're going to wait and go back and have a wedding in the States.
I got it. Your charge cord.
Oh.
But one of the places that moved me more than any other while I was in Europe was a little town called Rothenburg that maybe some of you have been to. This is probably one of the more famous pictures from Rothenburg. If you're into history, this is where you should go when you're in Germany. It's an amazing little place. It's in, I think it's Franconia in the Bavarian part of Germany. And also, if you love Christmas, Rothenburg is like the epicenter of Christmas. There's actually a Christmas museum there. If you've heard of Katie Wolfart, Nutcrackers, the little, I think they're called Hans Knödels. They're little, we call them the smoker guys. You put incense in them and they have like a little pipe and smoke comes out. Or you've seen those sort of pinwheel propeller deals with candles under them where there's elaborate things moving. Most of those are made by Katie Wolfart. So this is part of their museum. And then this is the store. So if you love Christmas all year long, just put Rothenburg on your list. It's a pretty amazing place. But Rothenburg, what's incredible about it, it's one of three cities in Germany that still has its original walls intact. Rothenburg was inhabited as far back as first century before Christ by the Celts. You can still see parts. In fact, the foreground in this picture, it's hard to make out, but you can still see parts of these weirs that were the system of weirs that were created in the 900s. There's a castle there that was built in the 11th century by a count. This is a truly medieval place. There were actually knights there, and it's still intact. One of the cool things is you can actually walk on the walls. This is a picture of them. There are towers all over the place, and you can do a walking tour around. But the reason I bring up Rothenburg is this building. This is known as St. James Church. It was built from 1311 to 1484. That's a 173-year building project. People began worshiping here. Here's the inside, as early as 1336. In 1485, it was finished and it was consecrated by the Bishop of Würzburg. There's another picture inside. That organ you're looking at, by the way, has about 5,500 pipes. It's a spectacular building to be in. And to walk in the St. James Church in Rothenburg, to me, felt like I was literally rubbing shoulders with generations and generations and generations of people that came before me who gathered there to worship. It's just phenomenal. There's stained glass everywhere. I could get into the Gothic architecture and bore us all, but there's stained glass everywhere. There's art everywhere. When you walk in, this is one of the first things that just grabs your attention. This is called the Altar of the 12 Apostles. But what really captivated me, and this is why I bring all of this up, is this. This is known as the Holy Blood altarpiece, and it was carved by a man named Tilman Ryman Schneider. Spent a good chunk of his life carving this out of lime wood. It was, again, done in the late 1400s, early 1500s, has never been painted and still looks fantastic. The detail of it is just incredible. This is on the left side. This panel depicts the entry into Jerusalem. And on the right side, that's supposed to be at Mount of Olives. And this is a closer up shot of the middle. It's just, it's this phenomenal piece of art that was carved hundreds of years ago. And when I was visiting this church in Rotenburg and just totally enraptured by this amazing giant piece of wood that was carved, I couldn't help but just try to picture Tilman Reimann-Schneider, the guy that carved this. I wonder if he recognized that his work was worship. I wonder if he was just doing a job, or what it was like for him and the others to give massive parts of their lives to creating art or stained glass or just laying stones in this building that took 173 years to complete. All these artisans, these bricklayers, these carpenters, roofers, as they built a place of worship, did they understand that their work was connected to worship? It's a question. I remember standing before this thing and just being overwhelmed. And did this guy understand? Surely he didn't know it would still be there in 600 years. But was he able to connect his chisel and his hammer to the idea that this was an act of worship? The past few weeks, we've been discussing this idea of work. We've discussed calling. We talked about the fact that work isn't a curse. It's actually something we were created for. Last week, we talked about how God often meets us in our work. If you'll remember, we talked about Peter and the other apostles. We talked about the difference between a profession and a vocation, and the way that God, those are shared by all of us, but God calls us to unique careers. But this morning, I just want to view work itself as worship for a few minutes, if that's possible. I don't think you have to be a master carpenter or master carver like Reimann-Schneider. I think the person who sweeps the floors in St. James could worship as they work just as much as the artist did. Romans 12, you probably know this. Paul writes at the very beginning of the chapter, Romans 12, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Now, Paul's writing to a group of people that had known worship as they worshiped all their various false gods as leaving things, leaving money, leaving food, leaving things of value. And now they've come to Christ and literally don't know how to worship because what they used to do doesn't work. As I was preparing this week, I thought regarding Romans 12, probably Paul could write a similar way to us during COVID, because we're used to worshiping music. We're used to worshiping physically gathered in a place. We can't do that right now. So what does it look like for us to worship? We face a similar situation that Paul's audience did. So Paul tells the Romans that they worship by offering their physical bodies. So what do you do with your body most of the week? A lot of us work. That's what we do with our body. Can work be a spiritual act of worship? Is that what Paul's getting at? Last month's memory verse, if you were paying attention, was Colossians 3:23, which reads, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. And if you remember, when we looked at this passage, it was addressed, in fact, to servants, actual servants who had actual masters. And Paul says, even to them and these menial tasks that they did, to do it with all of their heart as though they're working to the Lord. This seems like worship. And so I want to make a connection for us this morning that I hope will be helpful for you. We're going to begin in Exodus chapter 34. Okay. Exodus chapter 34, 21 says this, 6 days you shall labor or work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, even during the plowing season and harvest, you must rest, which was, by the way, a really interesting rhythm. If you know farmers, during the harvest season, the weather can be a real problem, and it would take great faith sometimes to rest for a day. But it's told, for 6 days you're going to work, and one day you're going to rest. And what's interesting is that the word translated here as labor or work is the same word we saw a couple weeks ago in Genesis 2, when God... Genesis 2:15 says the Lord God took the man and placed him in the garden. And he was there to take care of it. And that's that same word for work. He was there to work the ground. Now, I'm going to bore you for a second, okay? If you're not into language, or maybe I'll just give you, this is like one of those, you can sound really smart things. That word that's translated as work is a Hebrew word, avad. It gets actually translated, pronounced a few different ways because vowels are problematic with Hebrew. But this word comes up again and again and again. It's all over the place as work. It's work. And it shows up especially through books like Exodus and Deuteronomy. But I want you to hear a couple examples here. This is the beginning of Exodus 1. This is verses 12 to 14. This is as the people of Israel are beginning to be oppressed by the Egyptians. It says, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. That's that word, avad. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor. Again, that's the same word. And with all kinds of work, same word again, in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. That word avad shows up at least three times there. Chapter 8, we read similarly the same word, but it's gonna be a little different here. Hear how it's different. The Lord tells Moses that he's to go to Pharaoh and say to him, this is what the Lord says. Let my people go so that they may, your translation may say serve, or it may say worship me. That's the same word. It's the same Hebrew word that's used for hard labor and for work is now used to say, let my people serve me or worship me. It's repeated quite a few times, by the way, that phrase is. The same Hebrew word gets translated as work, as labor, as serving God, and as worshiping God. I think that's fascinating. By the way, that word shows up almost 300 times in the New Testament, and it's used in all of those ways, most often as work. Interestingly, if we want to go a little deeper in language, avad is a verb. The noun that comes from it sounds very similar. It's aved, and it means servant. It means, in the very practical sense, somebody who works for somebody. Joshua famously declared, some of us may have this on the wall at our home, Joshua 24:15. He's before the people trying to force this decision that they would serve God or not pretend like it anymore. And he says, but if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your ancestors serve beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. And then he says this, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. That is that same word. That is the same word that gets translated as worship, the same word that gets translated for labor and for work. So Joshua's giving the people essentially a choice. You can either work for these other gods or you can work for the true God. You can either serve these other gods or you can serve the true God. We could put in that same phrase and it will make perfect sense. You could either worship these other gods or you could worship the one true God. Now, I want to think about these other gods that were alluring to these people. Why would they want to serve false gods? Well, these false gods brought with them the promise of things like security and prosperity and infertility. And so the people could either choose to work to chase after things like security and prosperity, or they could choose to serve, work, worship God. It's not that different than the choice we face today, right? By the way, if you want to do an interesting study, it's not a quick one, mind you. You might look up this week how many times in the Bible God's people are referred to as servants. So what does a servant do? A servant works for their master. That's what a servant does. In the Bible, work and worship are hand in hand. In fact, sometimes we could say they're almost indistinguishable from one another. Even think about things like how worship took place. If you think about a Jewish person wanting to go to the temple and make sacrifices and worship in that manner, for most of them, that meant they spent a long time working to raise an animal or to gather wheat or to make the various things they would bring. And there was a very direct connection between the work that they did and the sacrifices they gave God. They didn't just show up and grab something on the spot and give it as a sacrifice. They worked for a long time to create, to bring that thing that they then gave to God. That's how the sacrificial system in the temple worked. So again, hear the words of Paul to the Colossians. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. Again, he gives us a choice similar to Joshua. Joshua said, you can serve these false gods or you can serve God. And Paul's saying, you can serve human masters or you can serve the Lord. In both cases, it's work. It's just who are you working for? Because if you're working for the right person, it's also worship. I think this was at least part of what Paul had in mind when he talked about offering our bodies as living sacrifices. This is what it looks like for life, for work, to be worship. And yet we disconnect them, right? Worship's what we do on Sunday, but work's what we do the rest of the week. How does that look different in your life if those words are synonymous with each other? Whether you're a teacher or you're retired or you're a student or whatever it is you do, how does it look different to work for the Lord versus to work for other things? That's really the question before us. Now, I can imagine it might have been easier for Tillman Ryman Schneider to see his work, his carving wood, art for a church, no less. It might have been easier for him to see that as worship than it was for those tilling the fields outside of Rotenburg. But I also imagine, in fact, I'm pretty sure he had bad days just like we do. Went in and hit the chisel wrong and had to do a bunch of work over. He probably had days he just went to work. I'm sure he had days he didn't want to work. But what he made has stood for 600 years as a reminder of Christ. Do you see your work as a form of worship? Do you see your work as a form of worship? We talk about being a witness at work, but do you see the work itself as a form of worship? I read a story this week about some bodybuilders on a TV show, and they were showing off their enormous muscles and their chiseled bodies for the camera. And the host asked them what they used their muscles for. And one man answered by smiling and flexing his muscles in front of the camera, you know, kind of one of those poses. And he said, no, you don't understand me. What do you use these muscles for? And another one said, I'll show you. And, you know, did the pose. I can't even do that. And he said, no, you don't understand. What do you use them for? And they posed again. The idea being they put a lot of time and effort into being bodybuilders, but had no idea what those muscles were for beyond vanity and competition. I think in a similar way, sometimes we gather to worship, we read the scriptures, we pray, we build spiritual muscles, but do we understand what they're used for? I would argue they're used for work, largely. And when we use them for work in a way that honors God, that is our act of worship. Again, you and I were created to partner with God in the kingdom of heaven. We do that largely through our work. So I want to just give you this vision of what you do during the week can be done unto the Lord. And when it is, it becomes an act of worship.